The next case this morning is number 06-2976, the United States against Blinn.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Mr. Brookman. My name is Robert Hammerly. I'm representing Mr. Blinn. Your Honors, before asserting what this case is about, let me state briefly what it's not. This is not a case such as has been cited by the case of Swigert or the case of Gibson, where an individual comes before you pursuant to and having been sentenced to an 11C1C plea where he's asking to get out of the benefit of his bargain. This is not a case in which an individual like Mr. Blinn agreed to a binding plea and then, discovering that there was something better available, tries to take advantage of that by attacking that plea later. To the contrary, Mr. Blinn entered a binding plea that called for a range of 12 to 20 months imprisonment. And what this case is about is that he received a sentence, a punishment, that exceeded that maximum by 40%. Namely, that he received a sentence of imprisonment of 16 months, which was added to a sentence of home detention for 12 months as a condition of supervised release. Your Honors, there is another thing at stake here besides Mr. Blinn, and that is the integrity of the process at the trial level. Because what attorneys do regularly with the U.S. Attorney's Office is enter into binding pleas that their clients trust the advice given by counsel, that they know the best and the worst that can happen. They know that before a sentence is announced that a trial judge is going to tell them if he or she is not going to follow the plea, that he will be given a chance to withdraw his plea, and that furthermore, that they can rely upon that contractual arrangement. If this plea is upheld by Mr. Blinn, it strikes at the heart of the integrity of the process, that process engaged in by attorneys like me and, I do say, Mr. Brookman. Mr. Blinn has entered into an 11C1C plea in which, as this court knows, that punishment is an essential term of that plea. Indeed, the punishment that was called for was 12 to 20 months imprisonment. I'm not standing here before you asserting in any way, shape, or form that there is a distinction or that there should be no distinction between imprisonment and home detention.
Can you deal with the Elkins case where we rejected an argument similar to the one you're making today? Are you suggesting Elkins was wrongly decided?
No, I'm not. What I'm suggesting here is that in this case, that the maximum sentence that could have been received, and which was not addressed, I believe, in Elkins, the maximum sentence here was 20 months. If indeed the court was going to give a period of home detention, the court could only, pursuant to the guidelines, give home detention as a substitute for imprisonment.
He said it was part of supervised release.
Excuse me?
The court said it was part of supervised release.
Yes, it was, and here it was part of supervised release. But what is a part of supervised release, in this case, what happened to Mr. Blinn is he received more than the maximum. The combination of imprisonment and home detention exceeded the maximum that the plea agreement allowed, namely 20 months. To read the home detention statute, which says that home detention, or the guidelines, 5F1.2, to read that guideline, it says that home detention, while it may be imposed as a term of supervised relief, something that we concede, it can only be done as a substitute for an imprisonment. Now, in order to deny Blinn relief, with all due respect, you would have to say that the last 5-7 words, it can only be used as a substitute for imprisonment, means nothing. It means nothing. But it has to mean something. The common sense meaning is it's used as a substitute for imprisonment. If indeed Mr. Blinn would have received 20 months imprisonment at his sentencing, I'm here saying that he could not, under the cases that we cited, which are not in this district, a sister district in the second, the Leopard case, that the court could not have given him a period of home detention if they would have given him the maximum of 20 months imprisonment because there was nothing to substitute it for. As a result, that this case is unique and different from Elkins in the sense that he walked away from a sentence that indeed exceeded the maximum. And I think what's at stake here and what the court, with all due respect, has to decide is the meaning of that phrase, where home detention, while granted it can be imposed as a term of supervised release, it can only be used as a substitute for imprisonment. Let me also say this, that at the time that Mr. Blinn entered this plea, the plea agreement specifically stated that if the court was not going to follow it or was going to reject it, that he would be addressed and told that, and he would be given a chance to withdraw that plea. The trial court also told him that at his guilty plea. This is an issue here where that in terms of him walking in thinking the worst he could get was 20 months of punishment, he actually walked away with 28, and he was not addressed in the fashion by which he was promised. We ask the court to remand this for a sentencing in which Mr. Blinn can proceed to sentencing pursuant to the binding plea that he agreed to with the government. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hammerly. We'll hear now from Mr. Brookman.
Your Honors, good morning. May it please the Court, Mr. Hammerly. My name is Matt Brookman. I'm an assistant U.S. attorney in the Southern District of Indiana. I'm here before the Court today to ask this Court to affirm the sentence that was imposed on Mr. Blinn as a result of his guilty plea. What Mr. Blinn could reasonably expect from his 11C1C guilty plea was that he would get between 12 and 20 months imprisonment, that the Court would send him to the penitentiary for not less than 12 months, but no more than 20 months. That's what he could reasonably expect from the plea agreement. And what he was sentenced to, 16 months, was within that 11C1C binding plea agreement.
But when we look at 5F1.2, it provides that home detention may be imposed as a condition of probation or supervised release, but only as a substitute for imprisonment. Isn't this in line with our holding in Swigert, which recognizes the distinction between imprisonment and home detention?
Your Honor, I think in Swigert, this court decided whether a defendant who had a binding plea agreement for 8 months imprisonment and then came to the court, came to the district court, the sentencing court, and asked them to satisfy that 8 month sentence with 4 months in the penitentiary and 4 months on home confinement. And the court said that it could not do that because 8 months in the penitentiary meant 8 months in the penitentiary and that the 4 months of home confinement would not be a substitute for penitentiary time. So I believe that Swigert actually supports the exact opposite view. And I think, although it's not the same procedural facts as our present case, the Swigert decision is very clearly sets out that home confinement is not the same thing as penitentiary time or Bureau of Prisons time. I think that point is made in the guidelines, and although we're in a post-Booker world and the guidelines are advisory, the Swigert Court looked to the guidelines to support its view that you could not exchange home confinement time with Bureau of Prisons time. And more importantly, I think, is to look at the plain meaning of the term imprisonment versus the plain meaning of home confinement. In this case, home confinement was confinement at home except for the purposes of employment, education, medical treatment, religious worship, and other activities approved by the probation officer. So I don't think anybody, including Mr. Hammerly, can seriously argue to the court that being at home, allowed to go to work, go to church, go to school, other things that you might apply for and get permission from your probation officer, that that's the same thing or any equivalent at all to being in the Bureau of Prisons. Common sense tells us that home confinement is not the same as BOP time. The home confinement that was put on Mr. Blinn in this case was a condition of his supervised release. The plea agreement was silent on the issue of supervised release. However, the parties clearly understood and had a reasonable expectation that supervised release would be a component of the sentence. On appeal, I don't believe that Mr. Blinn is arguing that the court had no power to give him any supervised release. He's just arguing that the supervised release, together with the imprisonment term, exceeded the maximum term that the court could impose. And as I've said before, the court did impose a prison term within the C1C binding range, and the supervised release was on top of that and a separate component of the sentence. I'd ask the court to affirm the sentence that was handed down to Mr. Blinn. If there are no further questions, then I'll sit back down.
You have nothing to say about whether or not this whole issue has to be reached?
Well, Your Honor, as you're aware, this court dismissed the government's motion to, or denied the government's motion to dismiss the appeal. There was an appeal waiver in the plea agreement. Mr. Blinn was advised that he would, that if he pled guilty, he would be waiving his right to appeal. There was a factual, there was an error in the plea, waiver, or the appeal waiver. It referenced count one. And instead, Mr. Blinn had pleaded to a lesser or to one of the substantive offenses, count four. And I would acknowledge that that makes it the appeal waiver more difficult than it normally would, because in fairness to Mr. Hamerly and in fairness to Mr. Blinn, the government does draft these plea agreements, not the defendant and not the court. So we should be held accountable for errors. But I would say, with respect to that error, there was never any misunderstanding by the parties at the change of plea or at the sentencing that the appeal waiver covered the conviction that he was receiving for the count four. So I do believe, I think I was correct in my brief when I called that a Scrivener's error and not a substantive error on the case. I believe that the court, that barring that clerical error as to whether referring to count one instead of count four, that the defendant fully understood that he was waiving his right to appeal if the court sentenced him within the plea agreement. I believe that the court did sentence him within that plea agreement. I would note also, Your Honors, that Mr. Blinn never raised any of these objections at the change of plea or at the sentencing after he had been sentenced and knew what his sentence was. He never asked to get out of the plea agreement, never asked to withdraw his guilty plea, never raised any objection to any of these things. And because he did not raise any objections, the standard for this court is a plain error standard. I think appellant may have referred to it as a...
You only pled guilty to one count, am I right?
Yes, sir.
Four.
That's correct. Appellant referred to a clear error standard in front of this court on the appeal waiver issue, and I would respectfully submit that I believe it's a plain error standard, which is something more than clear error, as this court, I'm sure, is aware. That's clear error plus, you know, that that the failure to of this court to act would result in an innocent man being convicted, which is obviously not the case here, or that it would result in an illegal sentence, which I do not believe would occur here either. The appeal waiver that's put in a plea agreement is precisely for this type of situation, where the defendant post-sentencing has a novel idea concerning the law, an issue that he wants to address, but he wants to get the benefit of the plea agreement as well as address that issue on appeal. So I do think that the appeal waiver would apply, and that ultimately this court doesn't even need to reach the substantive issue. Thank you for allowing me to do that, Your Honor. And if there are no other questions, I'll rest.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
I have 4 minutes, counsel.
Thank you. Let me just briefly respond with this. The referral to Swigert, as the court knows, Swigert involved a specific agreement for a specific amount of time that that Swigert sought to avoid at the time of his sentencing. The court should also note that Mr. Swigert was offered a chance to get out of his plea by the trial court, and this court still reached the issue on appeal. Judge Williams, you ask about Elkins. Let me respond this. Elkins specifically noted that any failure to inform or any failure in this sentence was rendered harmless if the combined sentence of imprisonment and home detention did not exceed the maximum that Elkins was exposed to at the time of his sentencing, which I agree he was not. The distinction here was that this is an illegal sentence. It's an unlawful sentence because the maximum of this offense as defined by an 11C1C plea, which again where punishment becomes an essential element, was 20 months. And the combined term of home detention as a substitute for imprisonment and imprisonment exceeded that by 40%. Let me finish with just a brief comment on waiver. The waiver, if I will refer you to the guilty plea a dialogue that went on between Mr. Blinn and the trial court judge and was cited in Mr. Brookman's brief. The court stated that there was that the waiver applied only if the sentence imposed fell within the proposed agreement. So the court articulated that the waiver was premised on him getting the benefit of his bargain. He did not get that. And indeed, The court told him that if the court was not going to follow the agreement, the court would specifically address him and tell him he could withdraw it. The court didn't follow that. And finally, under plain error, there was no objection, but under plain error, the court can reach this as surely as you did in the Gibson case where there was no objection, where you found that it was plain error, indeed an assault on the integrity of the process, where a defendant received a sentence that exceeded the maximum allowable at the time of the sentence, which it did happen here. We would again ask for the relief to remand this for a sentence so that Mr. Blinn can just get that which he agreed to accept. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Indeed, our thanks to both counsel in the case. It will be taken under advisement. We've finished the call of the day, and therefore the court will rise until 9:30 tomorrow morning.